So, it's a supreme honor being with you all this evening, especially with the topic of this gravity, having a large group of people come out to talk or listen to a talk, and I hope dialogue with me some in the Q&A time. Thank you for being here. I hope my presentation isn't too technical, but as I see we're a nice broad spectrum of people here. I don't know exactly who I have in my audience. I was speaking at the Mayo Clinic last night and did most of my preparation with them in mind. And this is a very pleasant extra getting to speak to you. I'm going to be sharing some thoughts about what we've done in the Netherlands, trying to walk you through the process, and then make us aware of some of the consequences of the kind of decisions that the Netherlands has made. And you know, we're the first nation in the Western world that has fully legalized the act of killing a fellow human being without that being for the reason of a crime. The only crime being maybe having suffering. I have the words euthanasia and assisted suicide. In your flyer, you were talking about assisted suicide because that is the policy of choice that is considered here in the US. But in the Netherlands, we actually have opted for a much more active role for the physician, as though it were a more moral way to go. You know, let the doctor take his responsibility and not leave the burden on the patient to deal with their pain, etc. But boldly, we'll go and do that. I think profoundly wrong-headed, but it's good to notice that there is a difference in the kinds of policy that we're talking about. Now, you'll hear me using some euphemisms, life-shortening treatment, and that sort of thing in the course of my lecture. That's because of the discourse in the Netherlands and the way that we talk about these things. Let it be clear that what we're talking about is killing. Whatever euphemism we use, the issue at point is the ending of the life of a fellow human being in an artificial way, and that equals killing. And it's important to say that, to not let the euphemisms soften up our hearts. We need to be honest about what we're doing. It was said that I am involved with the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. We've actually rebranded it, and it's become the End of Life Care Europe, and that's because we're not just concerned about formalized euthanasia according to our protocols, but all the side effects, and amongst other things, especially in the way that, medicine is dealing with end-of-life palliation. How much shortening of life are we allowing in the way we go about our palliation? I'll say a little bit about that in the end of my presentation. Now, when we in the Netherlands made the move to legalize, to formally legalize, we did so because we had a practice that we'd allowed to grow, and I'll say a little bit more about how that came about. And we thought that by formally legalizing, we would stop the tendency of backdoor euthanasias, you know, things that weren't according to a kind of formal protocol but were the ending of human life nonetheless. We thought that we'd have to clean things up and, you know, stop the backdoor euthanasia from taking place, which was basically the abuse of palliative means. And we thought that we'd be able to stop the incremental extension. What does that mean? That means the growth of the kind of things for which we thought it was appropriate to kill somebody for. We thought that by putting it in clean definitions, we would stop that. Profoundly mistaken. On both these points, exactly the opposite has happened. And I'm not just thickening it because I'm you know, emotionally opposed or something. No, these are facts on the ground, and I'm going to be arguing this case with the data. So you have to bear with me. It's a slightly data-heavy presentation, but I think we're more helped by looking at the things that are actually happening than simply sharing sentiments together. The most recent development, I'll start with that first. In the Netherlands, October 2016, our Minister of Health, Minister Schippers, and the Minister of Justice, Van der Steur, brought a suggestion to Parliament. They tabled a law called het voltooid leven wet. Voltooid leven, you see that. Basically it means a completed life or a finished life, is maybe a better translation. And the suggestion of this policy is that there where we started out with the law that was meant for people with physical pain, it then shifted and went to include people with psychiatric suffering more and more, and I'll show you the data. And then now it's come to the point where we want to make it possible for people who are 75 years and older. How arbitrary is that kind of line in the sand, by the way? But people that are 75 years and older, we want to make it possible for them, if they're tired of life, i.e. have no physical condition which would merit a euthanasia, no psychiatric condition which would merit a euthanasia, but simply being existentially tired of life, that they can then get themselves help to get killed. And the shocking thing is that this law might actually make it through our parliament. So we're not talking about science fiction here. We're talking about what's actually happening right now. We're in the midst of a government coalition forming. We've just had an election. And this issue was a decisive issue in the coalition procedures up till now. One of the parties, DC66, has refused to work with one of the Christian minority parties, which would otherwise have given them a coalition majority. But they refused to work with them because of this issue. So it's a, as we say, it's a coin on its edge. In Bibelchops and Dati, in Dutch, it can go either way. And I'm definitely rooting for us to not go this way, because I consider it at the least extremely ageist, you know, sort of a discrimination against a certain group. Why would a 75-year-old's life be less worthy of protection than a 74-year-old's? I don't know. It's a discussion which has been simmering in the Netherlands under the name the Pil of Grion discussion. And that was because back in the mid-1980s, there had been a politically active lawyer who'd suggested a euthanasia pill. And one of the side effects of us maybe legalizing this completed life will be that we demedicalize euthanasia in such a way that we created a pharmaceutical industry that makes pills with which people can kill themselves. And we all know what happens with pills when you make them. They end on the internet. It's happened with all the other medicines. And I'm very concerned that we're going to be the source of the death of teenagers if we don't watch out. So a very serious concern. Now, backing up just a little bit, don't think that the Dutch are an incompassionate, crazy bunch. I'm one of them. We couch this whole discussion about ending of life in compassionate terminology. It's the language of compassion which is driving us, which makes it very complicated. I know that many of you are people of faith, and we're all very aware that our Lord calls us to compassion. The only thing is that what has happened in the course of the 20th century is that we've had a shift in what the word compassion has come to mean. And this is very important to realize. You see, we're a materialistic age. We define what's good and bad, not on the basis of categories of meaning. Meaning is a very immaterial thing. It's what's crossing between me and you right now. And it hangs in the air there, but you can't see it. It's quite immaterial. No, it's not on the basis of meaning. It's on the basis of the presence or absence of physical pain. If something gives pain, it's bad. If it gives pleasure, yay, it's good. We call this a hedonistic ethic. That would be the technical term for it. And what it has led to is that people are inclined, if they cannot resolve somebody's pain with medicines, to say, well, then we need to resolve it with poisons, i.e. finish it. We need to get rid of pain, because pain is a bad thing. Now, profoundly misguided. You see, compatio, the Latin word, com means together with, communion means community, all sorts of ways of being together. Compatio. Patio is intensity, and it has come to mean suffering. The passion of the Christ, for example, there you have that word. Compassion is to enter into, or together with somebody else in their suffering. Yeah? To enter into their suffering, to become part of it, together with them in the suffering. While for us, because of our materialistic worldview, we've come to fill compassion to mean helping somebody else out of their suffering. Not me entering into your suffering, but me helping you out of your suffering. Stopping the suffering. That's what it's about. That's the physical materialist mind. And so, the language of compassion, misunderstood in this 20th century manner, has us looking for ways to end the suffering, no matter what. The truth is that most euthanasia requests have an existential or psychological reason. People don't ask for euthanasia because the pain that they have at the moment is feeling completely unbearable to them. Some do. But most of the people, and the statistics point this out, most of the people asking for euthanasia do so because of fear that the pain that they have might become too much in the future. Because the fear that they might have a shortness of breath, which would give them unbearable anxiety. Not the actual, but the impending. It's an existential category. You see, meaning plays a much larger role in human behavior than simply the physical. And we know that when you go to the gym. I've put up a little picture of somebody exercising over there. He's needing to work hard to get fit. We all know, if you're doing sport, that he or she who is not willing to take a little bit of the burning muscles, you know, the physical pain, will never get fit. They'll stay flabby. But this truth, which we understand when we're in the gym, we forget when it's about more serious things. The honest truth is that meaning outclasses pain. We need to remember that. Meaning is more important than pain. This is the reason why loving people who are suffering in the end of life is such a good way to be dealing with them, because you are entering into the realm of meaning. Relationships are the realm in which you mean something to me and vice versa. Not the realm of meaning. We need to deal with the existential suffering of people, which is often precipitated by loneliness and the fear that they are a burden to others. Many of you know your Bibles. I add a quote from 1 Peter 3, Peter being one of the disciples of the Lord Jesus. But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened. What we see in this quote is that suffering and blessing are not mutually exclusive. In Peter's mind, they can coexist. You can be suffering for what is good, that category of meaning, of intent, and be being blessed at the same time. For a modern mind, what do you mean? Isn't suffering the opposite of blessing? No, suffering and blessing can coexist, because blessing has to do with the purpose of your life, etc., happening, meaning busy taking place. I could say a lot more of it. I'll move on. Human beings live in the realm of meaning. I call this the weight of glory. Just to give an example, one of my students at meal table recently said, "Well, Hank, you know, we put dogs out of their misery if they're suffering. Well, why would we do less for human beings?" Now, it's true that we are organisms, but we're profoundly mistaken if there's no distinction or difference between organisms. See, dogs don't function in the realm of meaning like human beings do. Dogs function in the immediate. Where do I get my food now? Do I have what I need now? You and I, we're people. We've put up statues to people that lived long ago. We're very aware of the past. And we worry about how people will remember us once we've passed away. Very aware of the future. This is distinctive for creatures that are more interested in meaning than in physical. Sometimes this fear of how people might remember me will make me willing to forego having a meal right now or some other immediate thing for the sake of being seen to be a good human being. Meaning outclasses pain. It's the weight of glory. We have the gale force wind of culture breathing down our necks, or let's say in our faces. It's the new chic to have euthanasia and assisted suicide movies, and the main point seems to be so often that you have the point of view of non-disabled white people who all come to the same conclusion: it's a good idea to kill the weak. We're a society that loves liberty, Statue of Liberty. The whole, let's say, driving force in the Dutch debate is the longing for autonomy. And people make the mistake to think that dignity and autonomy, let's say, are inextricably connected. They are not. You know, to be dignified, I have to have control of myself. It's not true. Dignity, it's actually something that's given. It's a value which is attributed. I can treat you in a dignified manner or not. I'm attributing value to you. It's not something you produce by yourself. Let me be blunt about it. The fear is that, you know, somebody else might have to help me go to the toilet, and that might be terribly undignified. No, undignified is to not be loved. People are valuable, and therefore we must love them, and that is to afford them dignity. A short history. Both euthanasia and assisted suicide have been around for a long time in the Netherlands. The first legal court case was in 1973, and it's important to realize that it starts with the court cases. This is the lesson for the US. Don't wait until it's become a political issue. One needs to be dealing with it, first of all, as physicians who have a great voice in what the courts will in the end be feeling is necessary. First as physicians and then as a legal system. The first sort of move in the Dutch society was the Gertrude Posma case, and she killed a next of kin. She was a nurse and stuff, in name of putting somebody out of their misery. And the courts only gave a kind of slap on the wrist. A one-week suspended sentence was applied to it. And what was even more of an issue with this court case is that in the arrest that you know, what was written in the decision of the court, it became clear that they would have wanted to see a certain sort of procedural approach which was different. She didn't do A, B, C, D, E, which set the stage for a kind of procedural approach to be looked for by physicians. And by 1984, we finally get a deal between the Justice Department and the KNMG, the Dutch Royal Medical Society. It's called the Remmelink, in any case. This sets up a kind of protocolized approach of what the courts want to see, and a kind of agreement: we're not going to prosecute. So it's not legal, but we're going to allow it, i.e. not prosecute or criminalize it, if you do it according to certain due procedure criteria. And so starts a journey. Now remember this date, 1984. And let me walk you through this graph that I'm showing you here. I always find the visuals, powerful in this regard. What you're looking at are the comparative mortality statistics in European men. Now the green line is the EU 15 million. And in 1970, on the left-hand side, you see that about 1,300 individuals were dying per year per 100,000 men in the population. And all three lines you have there, the green line is the sort of aggregated median that the Netherlands should be comparing itself with, the rich countries around us that are similar to the Netherlands. Then I've put France and Italy, blue and black, just for a matter of comparison. You see that they sort of parallel that green line with some fluctuations, but they basically parallel the line. And then you have a red line, and that's the mortality statistics of the Netherlands. We were in 1970 one of the best boys in class, i.e. a very well-functioning GP system, everybody with their own personal doctor. And a relatively low mortality rate compared to the nations around us, doing better than the EU median by quite a bit. And then in the mid-1980s, we get a flat line. All of a sudden, we start to meander into the other line. Something different is happening in the Netherlands than in the rest of Europe. And it's time this changed, exactly with the moment when the Legal Justice Department makes a deal with the physicians about life-ending treatment. And by the end of things, you know, by the time we get to the mid-90s, we've moved out above the EU median. And the same holds true for the statistics for women. Actually, the change has been even larger in terms of numerically of women. And it's something that we see all over the world. When you have assisted suicide policies, or in the case of the Netherlands, euthanasia policies, they are more often applied against women. It's true in Oregon. In Oregon, 70% of the assisted suicides have been women. I wonder how many male physicians have been involved with their in the Netherlands, it is also true that we're seeing more women, percentage-wise, making use, and so a greater impact on their mortality rates. I really think that making nice, neat, clean ways to get rid of people is a woman-unfriendly issue, and it should set us thinking. The five criteria for euthanasia in the Netherlands basically are: you need to have unbearable suffering without the prospect of healing, and you need to have a persistent desire to die, and there needs to be a second opinion physician who agrees that this is all true. What's glaringly missing in our protocol is any reference to family or next of kin or something like that. It shows you how individualistic we are. And it shows you to what extent this being cut loose from each other is part of the problem. I'm looking at a set of people here, many of you who function in churches. I think one of the great challenges for diaconal work in this day and age is to engage the problem of loneliness. Because the whole Western world has become too cut loose. I grew up in Africa amongst the Zulu people. And that's a communalist society. It's a society of communities where people look after each other in a different kind of way. We can have all sorts of criticism about other things, but they do this right. And we don't do it quite right. As Westerners, we're cut loose like a bag full of marbles that are not connected. We were meant to be grapes, interconnected. You know, it's a challenge. It's a challenge for us to deal with the loneliness, which is often the underlying existential reason for people not to want to live. We shouldn't be killing them, we should be loving them. Now, there's been a great shifting of the labels that are used in the Netherlands. Initially, anything that shortened somebody's life with a medical procedure was considered euthanasia. But these days, the only thing that's in our euthanasia statistic is lethal injection after the due procedure criteria have been met. And so when you're looking at statistics of what happens in the Netherlands, it's only this category, which means that there are a lot of other more shady, gray area things around it, which are also shortening people's life, but which we're not calling euthanasia anymore. We might have done so once upon a time, but these days, even pain treatment with the unavoidable side effect that it shortens somebody's life is not a euthanasia, it's palliation, because you were intending to treat the pain. You know, it was slightly unlucky that the life was shortened by it, but it's not euthanasia. The history continued. In 1991, we started our government release of studies, which is the reason why you have so much data coming out of the Netherlands. I would counsel you to take a good look at the Dutch data because it's quite informative. You can learn a lot from it. Now, there are a lot of people making claims about there not being any slippery slope, etc. I think that the data tells another story. By the time 1991 had come around, in the Netherlands, 9.1% of all annual deaths in the Netherlands were in some way physician-induced. Now, this doesn't mean that they were all explicit euthanasias. A lot of the numbers in the statistic were also people who were, let's say, being palliated heavily with morphine and withholding of hydration in the end. Those things were included in that evaluation back then. But look at the figures. 2,300 were euthanasia on request. 400 were assisted suicides. These days, there are less assisted suicides and more euthanasias. 1,040 were euthanasias administered without the patient's consent. This is self-reported doctor's data that this report is using. And a little footnote to that, 410 were incompetent. This means that 500 and something of them were competent and yet not asked and killed anyway. I mean, look, read between the lines with our data. It's pretty shocking when you come to think of it. How safe is it to make it normal for physicians to end somebody else's life? Now, we've tried to clean this up a bit with our euthanasia law and to increase reporting, et cetera, but the truth is that there still is a tendency of physicians in the Netherlands, because they've become so used to thinking of it as a treatment, while really, killing somebody is not a treatment. It's what you do when you stop feeling that treatments help. It's not a treatment. My own grandfather, the guy sitting in the wheelchair, he's my namesake, Hendrik Reitsma. That's my full name. I got it from him. He'd been in an old people's home for about 5 years. He was 80 years old. 5 years earlier, he had a stroke in which he lost some of the function of his left arm and left leg. And they then found a little spot of non-Hodgkin's on his gum. It was taken for biopsy. The report came back from the hospital. Yes, it was non-Hodgkin's. And at that point, the house physician said to the nursing staff, the next time he asks for palliation, because from time to time he had pain from thrombotic leg, let's sort of ease him out, you know, we'll instigate a process of morphine overdose and slowly ease him out. To my grandfather, there was not this explicit question, do you want to die, or anything of that nature. Also, my grandmother only heard doctors saying, well, you know, he's really going to need a lot of pain treatment because he's suffering quite a lot. And, you know, she was from the generation that respects physicians, whatever's good for him. At the beginning of the week in which he died, I was visiting him, and I wondered, why was he so lethargic and, you know, non-responsive? He'd been so bright and sharp in the weeks preceding. And then on the Thursday of that week, an aunt of mine was there, and she saw that he was thirsty and was giving him some water. And one of the nurses came by and said, no, 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 don't do that. You're prolonging the process of dying. And she said, what do you mean? He's thirsty. This was the moment when we as family came to understand that it was an active mode of so-called treatment to end his life. All hell broke loose, needless to say. But we were too late. He had serious pneumonia by that time because of morphine overdose. Your tongue swells up. You can't cough the phlegm out because you're less active, especially lung active and less active. And so he died of pneumonia the next day, even though we tried to instigate reversal of this treatment. It left us as a family very confused, hurt, deeply damaged. You know, and one of the tragic side effects of this event was that my grandmother, when she came to the phase of being infirm, she was afraid. She was afraid of going to an institution for care because she wasn't sure that she'd be safe there. And that's what you get when you go down this road. It stops being safe. She chose to go 200 kilometers down the road, 200 kilometers away, to a place where there was much less warmth and where there's no community. She lived in a 5 kilometer radius all her life. In the Netherlands, 200 kilometers is like, you know, 4,000 miles in the US. So, you know, we're a postage stamp of a country, a very small, pleasant little living arrangements. My heart really hurt for my grandma that she should have this fear and have it influence her decisions in this way. You shouldn't want to go there. You know, this is not just so. It's 20 years later now, and I'm still very active on this topic. It's never going to go away from me because I've become aware of how big the danger is. We don't want to live in a world that becomes like this. You and I are not going to feel happy in a world where this becomes the norm. So we have our government-run studies, Ahmed von Heide involved. I'll come back to that name in a little while. If you look at the data and what it's brought us, this is the development from 2010 to 2016. And what you see is that our number of euthanasias have doubled in 5 years. And it's ongoing. This is a linear graph. We have no idea where this is headed. If you look at the percentages, this adds up to, at the moment, more than 4% of all deaths in the Netherlands are euthanasias. That means people being killed with lethal injection, and growing. How many is it going to become? Is everybody going to end up dying with lethal injection? Initially, after the euthanasia law had been enacted in 2001, it looked like things flatlined. What actually was happening was that physicians weren't liking the extra paperwork and the double checks and involving colleagues, etc. They hadn't had to do that kind of reporting before the formalized legalization. And so less euthanasias were done, and actually more backdoor euthanasias were being done. And that's where I'm heading with my next point. But what you see is, once everything has gotten sort of normal and everybody's used to it, off takes that curve. And there's a straight line up, and we have no idea where it's going. Don't tell me that there's no slippery slope in terms of the numbers. They don't lie. This is a Dutch slide, sorry for that. But the dark blue large area shows you which kinds of conditions people are being euthanized for. And those are cancer patients. But in the graph, there are all sorts of other categories. People who have dementia, you know, one of those categories that is not really capable of giving informed consent. It's the red section. And the smaller red section, by the way, the numbers. There's also the piling of conditions. So you don't have any one medical condition that's considered unbearable suffering, but because you have a number of them, well, then you do qualify. And so we have an incremental growth going on. You see that in this graph of new ways that we invent to be able to apply this law to people who want to die. Want to die? Or maybe they're feeling pressured into it. You know that there have been no cases of prosecution in all the years that we've had a legalized euthanasia law. This last year, 2016, the report we had, 10 were evaluated by the regional testing committees as not meeting the due procedure criteria. But do you think any single one of them was taken to court? Nope, not a single one. We have no jurisprudence on our euthanasia law since it was instigated. None at all. You want to tell me that there hasn't been a single impropriety? And a lot of improprieties have been reported by the regional testing committees, but none of them are taken to court. Maybe that's because the primary witness just somehow never shows up on this one. end-of-life clinic, it's kind of mobile euthanasia unit in the Netherlands. If your own physician won't kill you, they'll come and do it for you. They are increasingly euthanizing psychiatric patients. And three times in the last year, they were reprimanded by these regional testing committees for not using sufficient due care with psychiatric patients. We see that things are multiplying in the direction of psychiatric maladies, which is very concerning because, you know, suicidality is a huge danger and a problem. Anybody who deals with the psychiatric patients knows that you need to do everything in your power to keep them willing to fight. Not give them an easy out. You know, when you open that door, there's a cascade waiting to follow. There was a case last year of a woman with semantic dementia. That means that she couldn't use all words or understand all words anymore. And so the physician used a word, serpipake, which means, you know, jumping, and used this as the term for euthanasia. Do you want to hippake? You know, do you want to jump along? Her consent was couched in these terms, and there was considered sufficient consent to kill her. well, in the documentary about her case, it was clear that there were some Mexican close by who were not sad that she was going to go or anything like that. You know, there's all sorts of red flags as I watched it. We've gotten to the point where we're not prosecuting when this kind of thing happens. Now, I need to hurry because I'm almost through my time. I want to have a few minutes for Q&A. I'm just going to say a few things about continuous deep sedation. This is a protocolized mode of palliation at the end of life. Many of you will be familiar with it. Sedatives form an important part of the medical tools we have to help people who are in pain or having a whole variety of refractory symptoms in terminal situations. The only thing is, they're tricky and we're quite vulnerable. Once you've made, let's say, the pool of physicians used to end-of-life treatment, you know, more than 50% of all physicians in the Netherlands have done a euthanasia in the last 10 years, which means that it's completely commonplace. 86% are willing. When in this kind of a context, one needs to be careful what to do with palliation. Putting people into a comatose state and not hydrating, we all know that the end of life comes near them. The moment of initiation becomes very important. I don't like the word continuous deep sedation as a protocolized label. I would like us to get rid of it. You see, palliation is meant to be the palliation of symptoms. Symptom relief is the goal. That's what palliation is all about. And we should keep it that way. Not continuous deep, but symptom relief. Also, in the terminal phase, you can titrate midazolam, the drug of choice these days, so that you can give a dosage which is appropriate to its impact on a specific individual. A little bit of trial and error testing it out. But you don't need to say, okay, now we're going to go continuous deep for anybody who comes to this point. We shouldn't be protocolizing continuous deep. We should be aiming at symptom reduction. In France, they've recently, 2015, had a big parliamentary debate about terminal sedation. Why would you need a parliamentary debate about good palliation? I mean, isn't that something that doctors should be dealing with? Well, it's clear that there's a little code language for something that might actually be looking more like euthanasia and less like just palliation. So I'm very concerned about this development, and it will be no different in the States that this is at least a temptation and a risk. We need to be careful here. Continuous deep sedation until death has massively increased. You know, in 2001, 5.6% of all deaths were happening under the condition of continuous deep sedation. By 2005, there was 8.2%, and many commentators take note that this shifting transition was probably people who had been being euthanized were now being helped to end their lives by another round. By this time, 20% of all deaths are being done in a condition of a terminal sedation. This is the sort of linear increase of medication. In the Netherlands, we allow for much larger doses than some countries around us. I put the Liverpool Care Path there, which by this time has not been used in the same way in the UK anymore, because people were critical of it. But the Dutch protocol allows for twice as much, and they're actually using those amounts. I'm going to rush over this slide. It's just simply proving the point that not only is that space there, but we're actually actively using it. The mean starting dose is larger than the maximum dose that the Brits allow. The Oncology Society, the IKNL, in the Netherlands, indicates that at least 10% of terminal sedations are happening in ways that were not meant under the protocol we have for terminal sedation, and most of them relating to initiation, which is too early. Professor Agnes van der Heide has been interviewing next of kin, indicating that at least 1,700 cases something goes wrong with terminal sedation. And this is something that's not being double-checked like our euthanasia situation. So the estimate is substantiated by other institutions. Anyway, van der Heide showed that there was a kind of replacing of euthanasias by palliative sedations between 2001 and 2005. This was a study done by, published in the English Journal of Medicine in 2007. Even the director of the Society for the Free Will End of Life, they're the political lobby which has been spearheading this, Petra de Jong, when she was still the director, she said the percentage of people dying from palliative sedation is rising disproportionately. I call this disproportionate because it obviously is not likely that in 5 years the number of people qualifying for this treatment would rise so sharply. While palliative care in general has qualitatively improved so much, in the meantime, it has all the signs of the fact that physicians are using palliative sedation as a backdoor for euthanasia. And so not only do we have this immense increase of the number of people being formally euthanized, but we have the knock-forward effect of a lot more life-ending procedures being done because it's become normal, because people have become accustomed to it. Shifting perceptions is the result. 86% of all physicians by this time are willing to do a euthanasia. Well, in 2001, when we started, only a small fraction. And this means that for those other few who are not, the pressure is massive. To be a physician and live your conscience in the Netherlands is very, very complicated at the moment. You know, the space to express your conscience becomes a theoretical space that's almost impracticable anymore. And I recently bumped into a student who had been a student at my branch of Le Brie. And she's a young physician, has her own practice, and I was at a concert, and I met her in the foyer. I said, "Hey, you know, how are things going?" Knowing that I had to talk about this topic, I asked her, "Do you have to deal with this a lot of people?" She burst out crying in the foyer of the concert. I felt really bad at putting her on the spot in a public place. But she confided to me, you know, "I feel dreadfully alone. I'm the only partner in my practice who's not willing to do it, and the others are really mad at me, etc." You know, huge pressure, lots of stress. You don't want, as a medical professional, to get into a situation where you have this pressure to deal with. 33% of physicians in the Netherlands by this time would be willing to euthanize someone for psychiatric reasons, which our law initially had not at all been intended for. 27% of physicians would be willing to euthanize someone who felt they were suffering from living, this very vague, fuzzy, completed life category. And about 30% are willing to apply to somebody with advanced dementia, somebody who by definition cannot express their will in a constructive way. Here you see the growth of the number of cases, 2011 till 2016 for psychiatric conditions. This is the growth of dementia. And we see that these categories are growing much more rapidly at the moment. They're the new turf that's being sort of opened up. And we should be concerned about those. 70% of all physicians in the world feel pressure to do euthanasia, both from patients and the next of kin. And you know, that people think they have the right, they demand it from their physician. It's creating a lot of stress. Nearly 90% of all physicians feel that society should have more attention for the burden euthanasia brings with it for the practicing physician. So we have this paradox. They're willing to do euthanasia, but they're feeling horribly pressured to do euthanasia, and they're not happy about it. A strange paradox, but it is the way it is. Slippery slope or not, I don't need to argue that case. It's become a massive slippery slope as far as I'm concerned. To close, coming to my last thoughts. We're a techniques-oriented society, and we find it difficult not to have, you know, a solution for somebody's problem. It's incredibly hard to watch somebody who's suffering. It might actually be one of the hardest things that human beings get to do in their lives, to see somebody else suffering. Don't look away. Don't look away, because when we cringe, we're closer. We're looking more likely as yourself, part of the command that our Lord gave us to love, than we might be in any other situation. You know, this natural gut response, this very physical feeling we had. We cringe at somebody else's pain. So these are rare moments. We're more beautiful when we're there. And we shouldn't push this away. We shouldn't try to stop that feeling by killing somebody else. It's our birthright as human beings to care for the weak and those who are suffering. But think about it. The goats in the field outside my home, within the hour, they're prancing around, bonking against their mum, demanding their milk, etc. Independent very quickly, within days. Human beings are helpless babes for ages. It takes forever for a human being not to need care and to be strong enough. All of you here are here by virtue of the fact that somebody, very often a mum, cared for you endlessly, was willing to care for you when you were weak. We should be willing to do likewise for our fellow human beings. It's what defines us as people. It's what distinguishes us. Don't stop being willing to care for the needy. Thank you. I see a question back there. Is it okay if I dive into the Q&A? I'm going to let you ask the question.
Thank you very much, because some of what you have told me tonight I didn't know. And I wanted to ask you the question about the doctor who did not choose to participate in killing her patients, and it was difficult for her. You said you met her in the play.
Yes. Not at the moment. Not at the moment. At the moment, the law provides for protection for a clause of conscience is built into our law, so that physicians, and it's not a right that patients have, so physicians can't be forced to do it. But we're moving rapidly in the direction of people feeling that it's a right. And the inevitable outcome is going to be that this becomes an entrenched human right. If something magical doesn't happen. And so I'm deeply concerned. But I just want to add, in practice, this poor physician, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of space. You know, so the fact that we have this clause of conscience in practice doesn't mean that a young physician who's just finished studying and wants to join a practice doesn't, as the first thing, have the colleague say, "And you know, are you willing to do it? Yes or no?" And if you're not, well, sorry, you know, we need somebody who's willing, because we're getting a lot of requests. And so in practice, it's really not working.
If you don't want this to happen to you, is there any place you can go where there are people who don't have this philosophy and don't practice?
Well, those contexts are there. My grandmother went to a very conservative, reformed old people's home called the Pintadero, because that's not important, because she was sure they wouldn't knock her off, you know, prematurely there. Yeah.
A physician who takes care of children with disabilities, do you have any information about the Dutch experience of children with disabilities?
Yes. It's another cliche that I am. He's asking about how the Dutch deal with children with disabilities. We, in 2006, we enacted a protocol. We didn't legalize, but we made one of those deals with the Justice Department that we would apply our euthanasia law to infants, replacing the consent with parental consent. And so we have a protocol for infanticide, and it's being used. In the years leading up to that moment, up to 2004, the New England Journal of Medicine was looking at what was happening in Dutch hospitals, and they came up with figures that about 100 cases per year, of which at least 20 were really lethal injection. The others were withholding of nutrition and food. But we were using lethal injection, and most of the cases documented then was spinal bifida and hydrocephalus. Dr. Thea Yedion, who works at the Erasmus in Rotterdam, very respected physician in the field, he's probably the most eminent physician in this field in the Netherlands, he's vehemently opposed to this development, because many of the cases cited are cases of which he feels that they were very treatable, cases of hydrocephalus and
what
Yes, we do. The advance directive is used quite a bit, but it's a tricky thing. I'm involved on the side with an organization called the NPV, Nederlandse Patiëntenvereniging. It's the Netherlands Patients Association. It has a fairly large constituent of people who are having, let's say, a more life-oriented concern. And they are helping patients formulate an advance directive that seeks to entrench protection for life. It's telling that people feel that this is a necessary thing. But on the other side, many people give advance directives, especially with a view to fears, the existential fear of dementia, of losing control of your senses, etc. It's a deep fear which has been fueled by the rhetoric in our society. And these advance directives are a very tricky thing. When I become seriously demented, I want somebody to kill me. Well, the truth is that when those people get there, their advance directive looks to be more valid than what they're saying at that moment. And the reality is that the average person with dementia, when asked, do you want to die, says, do you want to die? Are you crazy? And in the Netherlands, we've actually had a rigorous debate about this, where the politicians and the physicians are at loggerheads with one another. Because physicians, fortunately, are saying, we don't want to have to kill somebody who's overtly saying to us, we don't want to die. That feels terrible. And it should. Let's be clear on that. But there are politicians asking questions in our second chamber, saying, shouldn't we demand that physicians enact an advance directive if it's been there? So this is a very, very tricky zone, very messy zone. Yes?
This is just a point of clarification. The sister's very aware of this. Our Minnesota has something called a PULSE, Provider Order Life-Sustaining Treatment, and you may be aware of it.
Yes.
And unfortunately, even if we do enact the advance directive, that can be overridden by the provider who decides that that is not important anymore if you come into the ER. So we have this slippery sliding already where the physician and the person who wrote this, even if they were competent, it kind of can be slowly taken away from them. I have a second question I'd like to ask. It seems we have this great problem of not a loss of metaphysics. We don't have any meaning, as you said, for suffering. We worship the altar of choice and autonomy. And the loneliness, it seems to me as a nurse for many years, this looks like a tsunami. This looks like, how are we, one little person, going to change anything? We know we're a faith and we can change it. I would like to light a fire under everyone in this room to say, we will stop it together.
She's asking about, the tsunami of the loss of meaning the enormity of the problem. And indeed, the feeling of being powerless in the face of such a large societal trend can be there. But realize all the really important changes in history were bottom up. Our Lord Jesus Christ came to save the world, and He chose to deal with 12 pretty insignificant guys. Well, let's be honest, their significance has grown. Yes. Yes.
So I guess my question is, do you feel that the slippery slope argument is the strongest argument against the philosophy of the age, or do you feel like
I don't think the term slippery slope is useful, really. We can leave it out. I do think that the observation that it's not safe is one very definitely backed up by hard fact. And when our own sense of safety and the sense of safety of our next of kin start to be threatened, all of a sudden things change. You know, I stand here speaking, not only having my grandmother feeling a little uncertain, my own parents are getting older, and they are asking me to think along the bank, you know, help us get this organized properly, how can I, you know, which kind of institutions, etc. All sorts of fears are there. And so for me, it's not something theoretical. My generation in the Netherlands was starting to see the consequence come very close by. You know, somebody who says, well, I'm not too concerned about a snowball that's running away, I say, watch out, you're in the way. Yeah. Sorry, I'll go to you guys back there.
In the Netherlands, is there much discussion of elder abuse in general, such as financial, physical, mental, sexual, whatever, and how that intersects with this?
He asked a question about elder abuse in the Netherlands, whether there's much debate about it. There's actually some awareness of elder abuse, but not nearly enough. And one of the concerns I have is that, for example, in elderly care, we use a disproportionate number of psychiatric drugs to dumb people down because we don't have enough hands on, you know, on deck to deal with the large population. We're a population that is very large, it's a gray crop. And so the needs for care are huge. Let's be honest, we have some of these generational differences. But it's not a good solution to use psychiatric drugs for people who have age issues, not psychiatric issues. You know, so I'm very concerned that there's a broader package of not sufficient respect for the value that elderly people represent. You know, if you get me talking, and I know there's time now, on the value of the elderly in our society, then you find passion with the elderly. But anyway, maybe there's a mission for that. Yes. Thank you for this question. It's one of those things that if you look at my heart of hearts, this is maybe my deepest fear, that the monetary pressures are mounting massively all over the Western world. There's the shortage of funds for doing medicine and care is becoming more and more a pressing issue. You only need to know a little bit of math to know that, you know, the reason for our debates about things like Obamacare, et cetera, you know, I've been following the American news a bit over the last while. It's not only you guys, we have exactly the same dilemmas in the Netherlands, that it's costing a huge amount of money, and increasingly so. And it becomes very tempting for insurance companies, et cetera, to say, well, you know, we're willing to pay for euthanasia because those last 6 months of life are so expensive. You know, that it's a no-brainer that the pressure of money is barreling down. You know, we're getting an intersection here, and it's going to be costing lives. In the Netherlands, it's already the case that something like the end-of-life clinic is a working business case that's paid for by insurance. You know, I have an insurance policy which distinctly does not include euthanasia. I get a discount for it. I just want to ask about timing. We initially said, you know, until...
You can have a couple more questions.
We can have a few more questions? Yes, sir. You're on.
Do you, when you polled the 86% of physicians, do you see a difference between the older and the younger generation if one is more proponent for this? And is there a younger generation or maybe the general public that are more for this? Because I worry that if they are carrying, you know, 50 years down the line, we'll have a population that is all for euthanasia.
It's a tricky question, the question of how the age distributions are. I don't think that it is necessarily so that young people are more inclined. I think there may be know, sort of dulled their senses of become used to a debate in a society that's actively killing people, so it's the done thing. But the actual driving force in the Netherlands has been the people who were part of the hippie generation. You know, I had a shocking moment when I thought I was going to be anonymous. I attended a meeting of the NVVE and was a little disconcerted when I discovered I was the youngest guy in the room, and they were all very happy to see me because they wanted new blood and you know, an interest group. And it's slightly uncomfortable. But the issue is that the backlash, you know, the Netherlands had a very sort of heavy-handed Christian first part of the 20th century. And both Reformed and Catholic, you know, we were divided sort of half and half in the Netherlands. And there was something of a backlash against this in the 60s, this breaking free in the hippie era. And out of that came a generation of people who have been the political driving force. And they still are. It's also out of the corner of the NVVA that this Voltooid Leven, this and finished life discussion is coming. So I actually think there's an opportunity for us in the young generation. And I do everything in my power to appeal to the hearts and minds. And I find a listening ear. I mean, there are lots of yes, but. But isn't this just the way it should be, you know, kind of responses. But it's not loaded with this aggressive, we want our liberty, which is what that previous generation had. Let me go to a question at the back there.
Does the Netherlands have any sort of hospice program?
Yes. Yeah, the hospice movement, fortunately, has grown. Having said that, the risk is there that once again, monetary pressures, etc., space and beds, gets involved even in the hospice movement, and exactly how fast you try to process people through there and how you go about that in a society where life-shortening treatment has become normalized. So it's a challenge to keep it pure and keep it doing what it was set up to do in the first place. But we have some wonderful hospices, to be honest with you. There was a question over here, yes. They've not dealt with it any differently than most of the rest of Dutch society. You know, it's true for Protestants and Catholics alike in the Netherlands that they've far too much just been complacent about it. I had a Catholic guy visiting our center who doing some pastoring in a parish, and he said that he had to go back to his parish because in 2 weeks' time, because he had to do a funeral. And I thought for a moment and I asked him, in 2 weeks' time? How do you know already? And it was a euthanasianist. Somehow it's crept in as being somehow something we just need to live and deal with. I can't answer your question more technically than the fact that we're rather complacent. Okay, I'm going to allow for a question in the back. Yes.
I know this is my second question, but I'm curious about any medical schools or nursing schools that you know of that do not support this legislation, that do not encourage it, that understand
that it's better. The answer is no. In terms of we have a very uniform, formalized education system, and there may be some voices of individual teachers or professors who are concerned, but by and large, people feel that we're organizing things clearly. We might need to tighten up the way we do our organization of all this killing, but radically opposed to, conceptually opposed to it. There's no institution that's having that position. Shall I take two last questions? The two over there. I'll start with the guy on my left hand side. Please.
Do you have any thoughts on how to resist this sort of at the cultural level rather than the political, legal level? Not that it shouldn't be resisted on both fronts, but it seems like
Absolutely. What we need is, first of all, people who are willing to tell their lived-in stories. And I know how difficult that is. You know, I need to have the permission of my family to be able to tell a story like this, extended family. You know, and most people don't want to be reminded of it. They don't want to have to think about it because these are painful dossiers. And so it's tough to find personal lived-in stories, even though there are plenty of people who have horrible stories that they could tell. Secondly, the Gale Force, let's say, of the media, I would encourage the creatives amongst us to dare to tell some stories about the beauty of being willing to keep looking and caring for somebody who's in the hardest phase of their lives. You know, we need some inspiring movies, books, good songs written, etc. So the battle for the hearts and minds is one which is also fought at the level of intellectual argument. But I think the stories, as all good philosophy, you know, whether your name was Nietzsche or somebody else, the greatly impacting philosophy has been told in stories. There was one more question there, and I'm unfortunately going to have to. The second person over there.
My questions are similar.
Okay, then I'm going to give you the chance. It's your lucky day.
All right. But we, as little sisters of the poor, our mission is for the elderly.
Yes.
And as our experience with the elderly, we say we accompany them.
Yes.
And we often hear their voice say, "Take my hand, not my life."
Mm.
So in that way, we find that, I think this is what our church needs to be, to really share information, stories, how to deal with families, to understand, as you, in our language, we use the word compassion, and now they're using the word compassion choices and can be easily mistaken. And I like the way you put it, that compassion entering into it,
yeah,
and get together. And that's what the family needs to understand, how we palliate the pain of our loved one. Because you don't want to, you know, there is a whole thing to that. You know, after the death, we have to deal with the grieving. And in order to, we start as our mission, from the day they admitted to our place, we start walking with the families so that we can help their loved ones to live their life to the full until God calls them.
Thank you. I will hold on to it. Take my hand, not my life. I think that's it.
Thank you, sister, and for giving us the words that we need to. And this is such a dire project that you have in the Netherlands, and we could be facing that. But as Diane said, we need to light that fire under us and to respond. It's ours to care and to give. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, your pain, and your experience in the Netherlands. There's more refreshments, and there's a table over here that has some information on a retreat for healthcare professionals that'll be in October. It's sponsored by Curatio. It's a great retreat. We have them annually. And CMA, the Catholic Medical Association, also has some information over there as well. So enjoy each other's company and take in what you have heard. God bless.
Thank you so much.